Okay, family law. Let me just check my system here. This is your guide for weeks 7 and 8. Week 7 and 8, we're dealing with divorce. We've talked about this several times. You know what's coming. So this week, or this part of the guide, I'm going to talk about divorce, legal separation, and annulment. And then we'll talk some more in class. You'll interview someone in the class, and that person will be your client. And then you're going to draft a divorce petition in week 8 before you have a week off for spring break. I had asked you to go and look at the statutes and to break those down and summarize those. If you haven't done that, time out, stop, go do it. If you're listening to this before you do that, then that's kind of cheating. You need to do what I asked you to do. So we call annulment, declaration of invalidity of marriage. We're going to talk about that briefly, legal separation briefly, but most of what I'm going to talk about concerns divorce. The common grounds in a fault divorce were always centered on adultery, desertion, or cruelty, either mental or physical. And Illinois had a laundry list. We no longer have that laundry list. And then in the no-fault divorce states, the grounds for divorce were marital breakdown. And those factors include, you know, the degree to which the parties were unable to relate to one another, the extent of any differences between the parties' prior efforts to resolve their marital difficulties, and whether there's any hope for reconciliation. And sometimes there was an expectation that they live separate and apart. If you recall, or if you want to pull up while you're listening or watching this, the Illinois Dissolution Statute, 750 ILCS 5/401, you note some language that you're familiar with at this point. So first, the statute says that the court shall enter a judgment of dissolution of marriage when, so what that's telling you is it's not, the judge can't, it's not a may, it's not a possibility. The judge must enter the judgment of dissolution of marriage when these factors are present. So initially what it starts off with is that at the time the action was commenced, one of the spouses was a resident of the state or was stationed in the state while a member of the armed services. And the residence or military presence had been maintained for 90 days preceding the commencement of the action. And then the next paragraph, still within A, irreconcilable differences have caused an irretrievable breakdown of the marriage, and the court has determined that efforts at reconciliation have failed or that future attempts at reconciliation would be impracticable, not in the best interest of the family, is the term used. There's another route. If the parties have lived separate and apart for a continuous period of not less than 6 months immediately preceding the entry of the judgment dissolving the marriage, there's an irrebuttable presumption that the requirement of irreconcilable differences has been met. Now, we've talked a little bit and we'll talk more in class about the practicalities of that, but living separate and apart is difficult enough after the divorce, but before the divorce, it's impossible for a lot of families. So financially, fiscally responsible. If you think about your own circumstances, you have to duplicate everything in your life. You know, sometimes that's a hurdle. The judgment shall not be entered unless the court, to the extent it has jurisdiction to do so, has considered, approved, reversed, or made provisions for the allocation of parental responsibilities, the support of any children in the marriage, maintenance of either spouse, and the disposition of property. So that's supposed to all be considered when the divorce becomes final, the dissolution becomes final. Now, there's some other provisions of the statute, and I asked you to break the statute down, so I hope you cover those things in your summary, in your breakdown of the statute, but that's essentially it. This statute prior to 2016 took up, the amount of text that you're seeing there times two. So we've greatly simplified how to get a divorce in the state of Illinois. And that's, I know people will debate, but that's probably a good thing. We know that people are going to, if they're inclined to get a divorce, they're going to get a divorce. And if they need to get a divorce, they probably should get a divorce, right? So, I mean, we just, at this point, we're wrapping up domestic violence. If two people shouldn't be together, we want to get them apart. Declaration of invalidity of marriage, annulment anywhere else, typically centers on a lack of capacity or intent or breaches of state marital law. So let's take a look at the Declaration of Invalidity statute. Again, the statute, and this is 5301, starts out, the court shall enter its judgment declaring the invalidity of marriage under the following circumstances. And then it lays out the circumstances. A party lacked capacity to consent to the marriage at the time the marriage was solemnized, either because of mental incapacity, infirmity, and a whole list of things. Remember, we spent some time figuring out what a marriage was, and some people question that, you know, why you spend some time on that in a family law course with paralegals. Well, at some point you have to know that the marriage was in fact valid. A party lacks physical capacity to consummate the marriage by sexual intercourse at the time the marriage was solemnized, and the other party didn't know of that incapacity. They had no knowledge of that incapacity. A party was 16 or 17 and didn't have consent of their parent or guardian or judicial approval at the time they were married. Go back to what we talked about with marriage. And then finally, a marriage is prohibited. And we talked about the prohibited marriages. Marriages are still prohibited in Illinois. So is one of those. Okay, easy enough. You probably are not going to deal with declaration of invalidity very often in your career as a paralegal. Just not going to happen. Legal separation you may deal with, but again, the trend is we're seeing fewer legal separations, and there'll be a reason for that that we need to discuss, and we'll discuss why we'll see fewer legal separations. A legal separation is a decree or an order that the parties have good cause for living apart. It doesn't terminate the marital relationships, and the parties can't remarry. They're still married. They're just legally separated. It does provides certain protections, like it tolls the party's responsibilities for debts of the other person during the separation period. As long as they're living separate and apart and separate, all separate life operations. So, but again, you're not going to see this that often. Let's take a look at the statute. So legal separation, that statute starts out, any person living separate and apart from his or her spouse may have a remedy for reasonable support and maintenance while they so live apart. Such action shall be brought in the circuit court of the county in which the petitioner or the respondent resides, or in which the parties last resided together. So three different potential jurisdictions, right? And then the statute goes through all the things that the court would do. Right. Important stuff to be able to distinguish between those, and you've distinguished. One statute I didn't ask you to break down this week, but I did provide you with reading material on this topic, 5/403. 5/403 deals with pleadings. It's very important that you read 5403. And if you haven't done that, go read 5403, because it tells you some important things you'll need to include or make sure are included in your pleadings, your petitions, or any of these things we just talked about. One of the first ones, and we've mentioned this before, is that a petition for dissolution of marriage or legal separation shall be verified. Okay, verified. If you don't remember what that means, look it up. And we can talk about it in class, but you should know what that means. You should know when a verified pleading is required. What does that mean for you, for your lawyer, for your client? It also has to minimally set forth, and the statute lists six different things: the age, occupation, and residence of each party, and the length of the residence in the state, the date of the marriage and the place of the marriage that was registered, whether a petition for dissolution of marriage is pending anywhere else. You can't have two divorce actions going in two different places. That the jurisdictional requirements of Section 401 have been met, and that the irreconcilable differences have caused the irretrievable breakdown of the marriage. The names and addresses and ages of all living children of the marriage, and whether the spouse is now pregnant. Any arrangements as to support, allocation of parental responsibility of the children, and maintenance. And then any other relief sought. So you have to have those things listed. And in the reading that I asked you to do, the ICL reading that breaks down those pleadings, there's some good examples of that. And if you go back and look at the statute, you'll see that these things are covered in those ICL examples. That's the remedies or the things that you can see in this area of the law when we're trying to deal with a marriage on the other side of, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you forever, you know, all the stuff we talked about. On the other side, these are the things you'll deal with. Now, you're going to focus on a divorce, and you're going to, in fact, draft a divorce petition. Your client is going to be one of your classmates. And we've talked about these parameters, and if you're in wills, trusts, and estates, you might find these parameters to be a little bit eerily similar. So in Will's Trust and Estates, we're just about to the wills project, and I told you that if you don't have children yet, you're going to get some kids. When I lay out this project, the divorce petition, if you don't have kids right now, you're going to have kids as the client. You're going to interview each other. Now, some of you work in a law office or have interned in a law office, and you've had some client contact, but there's, and then some of you have also had civil litigation in the fall where we covered this in great detail. There's certain things that you need to keep in mind for an effective interview, and I'm going to focus on an effective family law interview, divorce in particular. So the first one is regard to the emotional context of the situation, and we've talked about this several times over the course of the last 6 weeks. Most of the things involving family law are emotional. Your clients are emotional, regardless of whatever side they fall on, whether they're at fault or not. Regardless, they're emotional. Keep that in mind. And we talked about, you know, you keeping in check your emotions, your bias, your own feelings that you may have regarding past circumstances that you've lived through, either directly for yourself or as, you know, a kid with your parents. So keep that in mind. Ethical considerations, all the things we talked about regarding the ethical obligations and expectations of both lawyers and paralegals. And then in particular, you know, that one that I told you about, the ethical rule on communication and why I provide every document that I receive and any document I produce to the client, whether they ask for it or not, there's a duty to keep people informed. And in this area of the law in particular, if somebody's informed, they feel more satisfied. Rarely do you have a client that walks out of the courthouse and shakes their lawyer's hand and say, "This was the best experience ever." Now, they may tell their divorce lawyer they appreciate their efforts to shepherd them through a difficult time and a difficult thing, and to get them to as good a place as they could, but you know, they typically are not overjoyed. Keep your ethical considerations in your mind and in your practice. Another important one would be, we talked about in this area of the law, you may deal with unrepresented persons. And there's the various parameters of that. Ask me some questions about that in class and we'll delve into that a little more. The other is good listening skills, active listening skills. And I know that you may end up, especially these days, having that conversation by some mode that is more towards the phone, especially depending on whether or not your office is looking to have people in the building. Don't take that route. Use Zoom. You know, use a way that you can see the person and practice active listening. Active listening is when I'm talking to you and I zero in on your eyes, your movement of your eyes, your hesitation, your breath, not smelling your breath, just how are you breathing? Your mouth. Not only what you say, but how you say it. You should practice that. Practice good listening skills. That is important. In the interview, there's an opening stage, an information gathering stage, and then the disengaging or wrapping up phase. So let me break those down. The opening phase, you're establishing the parameters of the interview and create this atmosphere of trust. Now, as a lawyer or paralegal, that client has to be confident to come to us with confidential information, with information that is relevant to their particular cause of action, what they're asking us to represent them with. In this case, a divorce. highly emotional. Now, there's some people that want to tell you all of the things going on in their life, whether you really need to know them or not. And they'll tell you all of the things going on in their spouse's life. And then there are people that want to be more reserved. They're not proud of what's going on, or they don't want their neighbors to know. And so they don't know you any more than they know a stranger in the grocery store. They're going to be reluctant to tell you these things. So you have to establish trust. And one of the ways we do that is by assuring them, anything you tell me is confidential. Now you have to watch getting goaded into providing legal advice, but that is also a blessing, as you may remember we talked about. So after you've developed this trust, you've set the stage, you've informed them of your role, how you're going to work with them. Hopefully the lawyer's been involved in some way if you get deeper into the interview, but a lot of times in family law, a paralegal will have that first initial interview. Establish that trust before moving into the information gathering, where you elicit the client's backstory and you fill in key details. So as part of your assignment, I've asked you to go and find go to ICL and look at other resources to have a client intake sheet available. And when you do that, that client intake sheet will have spaces where you can put down all sorts of information. Most client intake or interview sheets start out fairly consistent. Name, address, phone number, date of birth, all that kind of good basic background stuff. They may also look to and go to, educational background, work history, those kind of basic things. Get those things before getting into, in this case, the history. Married, to whom, when, where, children, born when, how old, living where. And then all the issues about the marriage, why the marriage is ending, what property, things they've worked out, things they haven't worked out, things that your client or potential client may have concerns about. And you want them to, after you get through that initial phase of providing the background information, you want them to tell the story. So let them tell the story and listen and take notes. The client interview sheet is not a document that you should use to transcribe every word that comes out of their mouth. Take notes. When they're done, go back and look at the notes you've taken. If you have questions, you need to fill in details, ask those questions. Fill in those details. And when you've asked all the questions and you have all the details and you're sure you have all the details, you wrap up or disengage. You conclude the interview and you let them know what's going to happen next. Now, if you were providing the initial interview, what's going to happen next is you're going to talk to your lawyer about this particular potential client. Determine if the lawyer wants to meet with the individual. If the lawyer wants to meet with the individual, then you set up the time for the potential client to come in, for the lawyer to decide. Remember, the lawyer has to decide whether or not we're going to take the client as a client. So a time for the lawyer to meet the client, ask their own questions, and then decide whether or not to represent that client. And then you make sure that you follow up. At that phase, you would also draft a memo to your supervising lawyer. Include the interview sheet. And in that memo, you flesh out all the things you observed you take some time and you look at your notes and you give your narrative of the client or potential client. You're going to interview someone. You're going to draft a divorce petition for that someone, but you're going to fill out that intake sheet and you're going to draft a memo to your lawyer before you get to that divorce petition. For our purposes, we're going to take all clients. Two important things that we want to make sure are included on that interview sheet. In the event that you're representing the respondent, a petition's already been filed and the person that's come to you, to our office is the person who is subject to a divorce petition, then we know that there's going to be a date where they have to respond. So what is the date? When was the petition filed? Make sure they bring a copy of the petition. The other circumstance, or the other thing that I would always ask and have you ask in anything related to litigation, and this is litigation, has this individual met with or seen another lawyer? And if so, who? Or sometimes it's more than a who. I want to know all the lawyers they've seen. Now, why do I want to do that? If you remember from civil litigation, well, somebody comes to my office and they've already been to three other lawyers. And those three other lawyers are, you know, in this case, pretty decent family law lawyers, do a lot of divorces, people that I respect. I'd have to ask myself, why are they coming to me? And there's various reasons why they may be coming to me. Either those other lawyers quoted a retainer fee that's higher than this person is able to afford. You know, they don't have the money. That wouldn't necessarily cause me to turn that person away. Maybe in your interview, you've determined that that person has some personality quirks or some red flags that may indicate that they're not interested in following the advice of lawyers. That could be the reason. Whatever it is, I want to know that, and I want to explore those reasons in depth. Okay. Now, I would always tell somebody who is faced with a divorce to go and interview two people, two lawyers, and pick one that you feel like you know, fit best with, that they're going to represent you and you can feel confident in what they're telling you. But if somebody's been to five different lawyers before they came to me, I want to know that. Okay. So put that on the sheet as well. Not something you're going to find in the pre-printed client interview and intake forms. So this is a guide for weeks 7 and 8 as we get to and through divorce. And we'll wrap up with our divorce petition before we take a week off for spring break. Hopefully it's weather like this. I'd take off my other shirt, get down to the t-shirt. It's almost hot. I'll see you in class. Stay well.